Insurgent Radio calling, Insurgent Radio calling, Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger in the Heartland, in the bunker, ready to go right next to Tommy's Terrible Tavern. Evil. Yeah. Evil Tavern. Yeah, here we go. And this is Show B. Show B for September 22nd, 2008. Moon's Day. Monday, all day. We got Guerrilla Radio coming on. Get ready. Hold on to your pants, man. He's going to give you all kinds of good stuff here. Here comes Wolfman Guerrilla Radio. We're not going to use his name anymore. No, we're not going to do that. Here he comes. Go for it, man. Give him that gorilla stuff.
It's Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. Guerrilla Radio calling. And I'm Frank Bauer, again with you for another episode of Guerrilla Radio. Let me set the parameters right now on who this show is for, and quite possibly who Resist.com is for, and who the insurgent radio programs are for. If you're a member of the NSM and you insist on marching around in a uniform behind a police barricade and distributing flyers and thinking that you make a difference, this show is not for you. If you're somebody that wants to fart around with these organizations and just eat, meet, and retreat and try to make some friends and hold hands with people and talk real brave about racial politics and how bad the niggers are, but you don't want to do nothing on the street, this show is not for you. But if you're somebody who's sick and tired of the same old bullshit that has been going on since the 20s, and you're sick and tired of the same old tactics being used against an enemy that has evolved into a much smarter, much more highly resourceful enemy, and you want to start thinking outside the box and maybe trying something new, then this show is for you. I want to start off, we will be reading out of War of the Flea, but I want to read chapter one of this book called Surreptitious Entry by Willis George. Now, this guy was he was hired by the United States government. They didn't have a CIA back then when World War II was going on. They had a thing called the OSS. Don't remember offhand what OSS stands for, but that was the precursor for the CIA. And basically what this guy did, he broke into the offices and office buildings of German nationals who were here in New York and Chicago in 38 and 39 and 1940, and basically just going through their papers without these German nationals know that they were under surveillance. So I want to read chapter one. It's only like 4 or 5 pages here. But the techniques that's used in this chapter, you can use them too. Or they can be used against you. Now, mind you, the government and the system has become a lot more crafty in their means of keeping you under surveillance. So when you read this, don't think that this is how they do it now. But I think they could still do it of this nature now. But this is something you can use also against a potential enemy. So here we go. Just chapter one. I'm probably going to throw this book away after I read this because, in fact, I'm going to save you the trouble of having to buy it, because really the only good stuff out of here is chapter one. So here we go. It says, the superintendent knew that the two men who came into the great, glooming, square-shouldered office building every night shortly before midnight and then spent the next 3 to 4 hours working behind the locked door of a stuffy little room in the basement were Naval Intelligence Agent Jack Larson and Agent in Charge Willis George. We were government burglars, Jack and I, but the employees on the night shift, it was a large office building in Chicago, and half a dozen men worked on the elevators and elsewhere all night, thought we were engineers testing a new air raid detection device. This cover worked splendidly until one night a new guy on the elevators became suspicious. What are you fellas really up to? I put my best Sunday face on. Hush, hush, if a face can be that and no end in confidential. Well, you know how it is. A rich dame wants to get something on a guy, so, oh, a couple of divorce dicks, he grunted and promptly lost interest. Building employees were frequently questioned by private detectives about the amorous adventures of various tenants, and to them, a divorce case is old stuff. The men in this building were no exceptions. Damn. Beyond wondering who the guy might be or how much, turning the page, how much money the rich dame was spending. They thought little about our activities because they fell into a familiar pattern. That's something you need to think about right there. If your activities fall in a familiar pattern, no one's going to give you a double take. No one's going to care maybe too much about what you're doing. In fact, I just got done talking to Tom Metzger off the air and told him how much I really like this show on Discovery called It Takes a Thief. And I've watched this guy with a crew of maybe two other guys rob an apartment building in New York, breaking into the building on a busy street with all kind of activity around, and nobody called the cops. Nobody paid him any mind because they acted very nonchalant about their activities. They acted with casual confidence. And their activities fell into a familiar pattern. It didn't stand out. They looked like some construction guys doing work on the building, and they basically cleaned the place out. You want to get some good strategies, watch that show. Okay. And that was exactly the sort of cover we wanted. We could carry on unhampered by dangerous curiosity. Each night we found the little basement room literally bulging with burlap sacks, all properly labeled. They contained scrap paper and other refuse collected by the building's cleaning staff from the offices on the 10th and 12th floors. There was a huge quantity of it, but most of it was a blind, whatever that means. I guess that means it wasn't worth any, it didn't have any intelligence value. I don't know, I read this book, and there's a lot of slang I'm not familiar with, so I guess there was certain slang in the 1940s that isn't around now. Okay. We were interested only in the material from an elaborate suite on the 12th floor, occupied by Stephen K. Zigley, who had come to this country from a neutral European capital a few months before the United States entered the war. Everything that came from his office was examined under magnifying glasses, tested for invisible writing, and if necessary, photographed. Whatever could be identified as having been collected from Zigley's own wastebasket was set aside for further study. Ostensibly, Zigley's business was banking and insurance, in both of which he had an international reputation. But American authorities suspected that he had other and more important business, that he had been sent into this country to organize and operate a Nazi spy ring. Unknown to him, Zigley had been under investigation by American agents in Europe for almost a year, and while nothing had been discovered that could be described as legal evidence, his activities have aroused suspicion. He maintained his own banking and insurance business in a neutral capital, but most of his connections were in Germany. He had made two trips to Berlin just before embarking for the United States, and he was known to have had very profitable business relationships with high Nazi officials. He claimed Austria as his birthplace, but he was a naturalized citizen of the neutral country, which had given him a passport. This and other papers were in perfect order when he arrived in New York. Even if they hadn't been, a way would have been found to let him enter the United States. The only way to trap him, if he should prove to be a Nazi agent, was to let him show his hand here. He spent a week in New York, living quietly in a good hotel, and as far as the authorities could learn, seeing no one except three or four businessmen to whom he presented letters of introduction. None of these men was involved in his later schemes. Then Zigley went to Chicago, where he signed a five-year lease on offices in this building in the Loop. And for those of you who don't know what the Loop is, that's the downtown area. Chicagoans look on the Loop as the act of God. Well, that's not. Hold on. Save some reading here. But within the irregular quadrangle formed by these daily wriggling are some of the biggest banks, department stores, hotels, cafes, and office buildings. And here was Zigley, a short, fat, important little man without any curves on the back of his head. He had insisted upon extensive alterations in his offices and rearranging of the suites so that a visitor to reach his private office had to undergo the scrutiny of employees in four rooms. soon after moving in, he complained to the building management that careless cleaning women have ruined a valuable document and insisted upon employing his own cleaning staff. See, he didn't want... See, that was smart on his part. He didn't want the building cleaning staff to be going into his building. So he, you know, faked a complaint, so to speak, and said that somebody ruined a document of his. Thereby, he could bring in his own cleaning staff. So, kudos for him. Okay. Soon after moving in, he complained. A little later, he entered his office late one night and found the night watchman inspecting the premises. Although the watchman was only making his usual rounds, Zigley became greatly upset and soon thereafter installed new locks on all inner and outer doors of the suite. He put a particular intricate lock on the door of his private office. Although Zigley's fussiness about his office had increased our suspicions, we let him pretty much alone for several weeks. We wanted him to make his American contacts, establish himself, and get to work. We gave him a month, then we went to work. Nothing of importance developed immediately. His business affairs were apparently legitimate, and so were his conversations and... turning the page, and correspondence. His social contacts were few and about what might have been expected of a man in his position. He talked and wrote little about the war. When he did, it was to express his detestation of war and a horror of the instruments and machinery of war. In several conversations and letters, he said that war had so greatly affected him that he was unable to look upon a gun or an airplane without a shudder of revulsion. I think he was overdoing it. You know, he basically poured it on too thick. So where some of his other activities later, which I'm about to read, piqued everyone's interest because he went overboard with stating his hatred for war and military machines and stuff like that. Whereas when they saw something else in his character that contradicted that, then they paid even more attention to him. So be careful what you say. Be careful about overdoing it. You know, just casual confidence. I keep saying that. You know, you don't have to overdo nothing. You don't have to impress anybody. Just be the person you pretend to be in your mind and don't overdo it. Okay. Where do we go here? Like I said, the lighting is very bad in here. It was after surveillance, censorship, and other methods had failed to produce any evidence of espionage that we decided to examine the scrap paper from Zigley's office. For this, some preparation was necessary. The superintendent of the building, whose cooperation was essential, was investigated and found to be a good American citizen. I went to see him and told him outright that I was a government man searching for spies. "We suspect some of the tenants of your building," I said, "and we want to look over all scrap paper taken from their offices." "I'd like to help you," the superintendent says, "but all waste paper is destroyed as soon as it's collected." "We can fix that," I said. I then gave the superintendent a list of some 20 tenants, among them Zigley, but did not name him specifically. That was smart of the agent in charge, not letting the superintendent know exactly who they were spying on, because the superintendent's not a trained operative. You know, he could act very suspiciously around this Zigley guy, and that would makes this Zigley more suspicious. You know, why is this guy watching me so carefully? Why is he, you know, going through my waste paper basket? Why every time I come to the office and in the wee hours in the morning, I'm finding someone in or around my office? You know, so this Willis George guy didn't trust the superintendent with the knowledge that, hey, I'm only interested in this one guy, Zigley. So he gave him 20 names, and any one of them could be, you know, one of the spies. So learn this and use it. Okay. We can fix it. I gave him a list of some 20 guys. All right. Several times during the next few days, the superintendent told his cleaners at my suggestion that any compliments were being received that any complaints were being that many complaints were being received by papers swept from desk into waste baskets and so carried downstairs to be destroyed. A day or so after that, still at my suggestion, I told him that a new system of waste paper disposal would be followed. Thereafter, all scrap paper would be put into bags and sent to the basement, labeled with the office number from which it had been taken. It would be kept for 2 days so that a search may be made if anything was reported lost. The superintendent himself each night sorted the bags and carried into the basement room the scrap collected from the office on the list I had given him. For 3 months, we examined every scrap of paper taken from Zigley's office. We found nothing, but we learned a lot about him. For instance, he was an inveterate doodler, meaning he doodled a lot when he was talking on him. I know people who do this. They'll talk on the telephone or they'll watch TV and they'll just have a pen and a piece of paper and they'll just start doodling, either drawing characters or words or whatever. So if you have a habit of doing that, stop. Because subconsciously you could be, a trained investigator can look at your scrap paper that you doodled on and he could determine a lot about you. So if you're a doodler, stop right now. Okay. And as the investigation progressed, we became more and more interested in the fact that most of Zigley's doodling had to do with war, a habit greatly at variance with his often expressed opinions. His doodles were nearly always neat little pictures of guns and ships, of airplanes and bombs, and occasionally there appeared among them figures, a design which bore a striking likeness to a radar apparatus, and another which resembled a piece of laboratory equipment. Finally, there came a night when we found on a torn scrap of paper half a dozen radar doodles and some words and fragments of use. Important, rad, meet importa, arrive. Them were the code words that I guess he wrote on his scrap paper. Subsequently, we learned that this jumble of words reflected Zigley's worry over the arrival of a German agent carrying information about American and British radar. At the time, the words seemed meaningless, except that it was obvious that they indicated the coming of someone whom it was important for Zigley to meet. Who this person was, what his business with Zigley was, these were facts. These were facts it was up to us to find out. And it was not the kind of information we could be sure of finding in a wastebasket. So a surreptitious entry was decided upon. That's where they break into your house, and you don't know that they broke into your house. You know, an episode on TV comes to mind right now. It's, I don't remember what season it was, but it was on The Sopranos. And the FBI waited for all the Sopranos, Tony Soprano and his kids and wife or whatever, to leave the house to go about their daily activities. And they broke into the house and put a lamp, or actually they went into the house, they took pictures of everything, how he had his basement set up. They took a picture of a lamp, and they found an exact replica of the lamp. And they took detailed pictures of this lamp while in Tony Soprano's house. And what if there was a little nick on the base of the lamp, if there was a spot of paint on it. I don't remember what season it was. It could have been season 3. But if you guys know what I'm talking about, give it a if you guys have it on DVD or whatever, give it a look over again. The FBI got a lamp that looked exactly like this lamp and marked it up, whether it had nicks or piece or splotches of paint on there or whatever, just made it look like the exact lamp, but it was bugged with a microphone, so he could listen in on to Tony Soprano's conversations and maybe get him on some RICO charge or something. So they had the technology to do that, so be aware of that. Okay. I'm going to stop the talk. I always lose my place. Maybe I should just shut up. All right, in some articles, this operation is called burglary. But when it is performed for Uncle Sam, as it was in some 200 instances in which I was personally implicated, it is usually called by the 64 word or words, by a $64 word or words. Whatever that means. I guess $64 word was surreptitious entry. Not that the verbal camouflage protects the government burglar if he is caught. He is on his own. He is without the law and so without hope of support or recognition from the government of the law-abiding country. I don't think that that's true today. If somebody's caught, I can't see that agent being on his own. They'll probably fake him going to jail and then they'll scoop him up out the back door of the jail. I mean, I just can't see that happening now. Okay. He is on his own. He's without the law. Even if he is fatally wounded in the line of duty, he receives no Purple Heart. To the building superintendent, I explained that a search of Zigley's office was a thoroughly illegal procedure and a quite different matter from examination of scrap paper. I pointed out that if the entry was discovered, especially if no evidence was found, the government would disclaim responsibility. The superintendent would face possible criminal prosecution, a civil lawsuit, and I don't like how this guy writes. It's just, I don't like the flow of it. I don't know. It's just, I find easier readings in War of the Flea. Anyways, lost his job and reputation. He listened carefully, and finally he said, okay, I'll help you. Do you want money, I asked? No, I've got two boys over there. Just make it look good. It'll look good, I promise. It was good. It was still impossible to describe in detail the information obtained in the search of Zigley's office, but it included conclusive evidence that Zigley had been operating a German espionage ring of a dozen agents in six large American cities. Some of the records in Zigley's safe contained the names and addresses of these agents. Others were carbon copies of instructions in the use of microfilm, invisible ink, disguise, etc. By 5:30 the next morning, we had completed our work and carefully destroyed all evidence of the search. Everything in Zigley's office was replaced. The desks were rubbed with a cloth to obliterate fingerprints. The floors were rewaxed. The dial of the safe was set to its original reading. The window shades were adjusted to the original height. The last man to leave as he retreated swept the rug to destroy footprints. Within a month, all of Zigley's agents had been rounded up and the espionage ring smashed. But neither Zigley nor any of his associates knew how it was done. No one ever discovered that our search had taken place. Nothing was removed. Nothing apparently had been touched. This was the unique feature of our extra special kind of surreptitious entry, a wartime emergency procedure which I am proud to say I had a part in creating and perfecting, as you will see. I was privileged to practice it throughout the war, first in this country for naval intelligence, then later in the European theater for General Wild Bill Donovan's OSS. So, I'd like to point out that I didn't highlight it, but I remember reading in this book that one of the ways they replace dust on a surface, because let's say someone had a safe, but there was a lot of dust on the safe, and if you handle the safe at all, you're bound to leave smudges in the dust, which could attract someone's attention. So what they did, their work, you know, and obviously they're going to disturb the dust that's on the surface of whatever they're working with. They took talcum powder and carbon, grind it up into fine particles, and mix the two together to give it kind of a gray appearance, you know, carbon being black and talcum powder being white, and mix it thoroughly, and then use this device to gently blow this mixture of talc and carbon onto the surface, thereby replacing the dust on the surface of whatever they were trying to break into. So that's something to be aware of. But you got to remember, that's why I tell you guys, you know, if you're a guy that's flying in under the radar and nobody knows about your racial views, and if you're one of those guys, then you need to be doing stuff. And I'm not talking about going out and distributing literature. You need to be more active than any one of these guys that has a swastika armband and likes to parade around like a clown. If nobody knows your racial views, you have no tattoos, and if you have to read these books, I recommend you keep them in another place, because if for whatever reason you become a person of interest, you know, with this Patriot Act now, these government law enforcement entities can break into your apartment, break into your house without you knowing about it. That, you know, if they were able to do this in 1940, 41, 42, imagine how much more they can do that now with the Patriot Act and all the other draconian bullshit government stuff that they got going on. So, like I said, man, these shows are for the few, the proud, the Aryans, you know. This isn't for the masses, these shows, because, you know, I'm watching C-SPAN today, and all these people are calling in about the financial crisis. And, you know, had some old guy from Mississippi with a real thick southern drawl, all concerned about Barack Obama becoming the president. And that just pissed me off because, you know, the institution of the presidency of the United States has become an enemy institution to those who believe in the survival of the white race. We have been sold out by every single president since Woodrow Wilson. Every president. So I don't know why it bothers so many people that there could be a black president. Listen, we've had white presidents since Woodrow Wilson. They've all hurt us severely. Yet Eisenhower sending troops, 82nd Airborne and 101st to Little Rock to make sure that the schools were integrated. Come on, man. I mean, you know, we've lost this country. The institutions have been turned against us. And you think you're going to change this at the ballot box? You think, oh, all we got to do is get the right man in there. You know, I talked to some of these NSN guys. They really labor under the illusion that all they got to do is just wake up the white masses and just get the right man in power. You really think that these these mega-rich financial vipers are going to allow that to happen? Are you kidding me? Look at what they did to Forrestal. I forgot his James Forrestal. He wanted to bring some action against the banking cartels and the secret government that was controlling the United States government back in the 30s and 40s. And, you know, they say he jumped out of a window, committed suicide. Come on, everyone knows he was murdered. Everyone knows he was thrown out that window. You know, and there's been plenty of guys. Louis T. McFadden. He was a congressman from Pennsylvania back in the early 30s, and he was always ranting and raving on the floor of the House, trying to tell people what the Jews were doing with our money and how they're usurping the wealth of America. And nobody listened. You know, they didn't have CNN and internet and cable TV back then. But, you know, he made a very valorous try to wake up people, but he was murdered. He was poisoned. So you're not going to change anything at the ballot box. You're not going to get the right guy in the goddamn motherfucking political office in this country. You want change in this country, it can only be by bombs and bullets. I'm sorry, FBI, if you're listening to that, but that you know that that's true. That's why you watch us so closely. I mean, you don't got to worry about me. I'm just the guy talking shit. You got to worry about the guys who don't talk shit. So... Oh, man. The thing that pisses me off more than anything is the... You know what? I don't even want to say it's stupidity anymore. I really don't think that the NSM really are cowards. Or not. I don't think that they're stupid. And I'm coming up with a new thought lately. Maybe they're not stupid. Maybe they're scared of real activism. And I know that's going to set a lot of guys against me, but... Every day I walk out my door and every day I turn on my TV and I'm a news junkie. I watch news. I watch MSNBC and CNN, and all I see is it getting worse for us. You know, And I know there's a lot of you guys out there, the FBI or the CIA, NSA or whatever. They don't know who you are. You were smart. You kept your mouth shut. You didn't get no swastika tattoos. You never went to any organization, but you've been woken up somehow. And you're the guy that's going to do some real good for this thing. Not me. You know, Tom Metzger can only do so much by trying to wake people up, but it's not like he can do any lone wolf stuff. Neither can John Metzger. We're too well known. We're the usual suspects. If any racial activity goes on in my area, I'm the first one they're going to sweep up. So, there's a lot of you guys out there that can do some good things. And I can talk this shit because I believe it. But who knows what the future holds? Maybe I am the 100th monkey. All right. You turn into 150 questions for a gorilla. And read a few questions here. Question, what physical training should a gorilla have before beginning any action? Answer, he will make long marches, gradually lengthening them until he was able to march 15 hours with a short rest of 10 minutes every 4 hours. Also, 8-hour night road marches will be held. You know what? You got to do more than marching, you know, going on road marches at night with a pack to get you toughened up. You got to do a lot more than that. And I've been thinking about this lately. You know, let's start preparing our bodies and our minds for the worst thing that could happen in this country. Suppose something happens, whether it's a natural catastrophe or whether it's man-made catastrophe. And the supermarkets, all the food's gone. You know, until that day comes, maybe try to get used to eating only twice a day. Now, you're going to lose a lot of weight, but at the same time, you're going to be training physically. You're going to be every morning or every afternoon or evening, whatever works best for you. You're going to be training with functional exercises for combat fitness, right? You want to be able to sprint 100 yards, and if you know, if you're sprinting away from a group of people who are trying to kill you, and you sprint 100 yards and you run into another group, you want some gas in the tank to be able to deal with that situation. You got to look at yourself. Yeah, I keep saying this. Know thyself. Know thyself. What is your weakness? You need to really take a good hard look at yourself. What is your weakness? If you're addicted to nicotine, you may want to stop smoking now. Get you know, free yourself from the from the master of nicotine. Don't be a slave to it no more. Whatever weakness you have, it can be used against you. Are you the kind of guy that can't go a day without, you know, drinking a few beers? I mean, you just have to have that beer. You want to think about that and your proclivity towards alcohol. You the kind of guy that has to have sugary sweets? You know, you have a weakness. You will be better for our race by dealing with that weakness. So get used to not eating as much. Maybe really train yourself to eating twice a day. Work out. Do good workouts in the morning with this functional exercise for combat fitness. You don't have to work out for an hour, an hour and a half like these muscle-bound guys in the gym. You can get a good workout in 20 minutes. And I'm telling you, you will drop the pounds like you wouldn't believe. If you do what I say, you incorporate sprints. Now, I do not recommend long-distance running. Long-distance running is bad for the joints. It's bad for your knees, your shins, your feet. You know, in the long run, it's going to tear you up. I recommend wind sprints. At least, find a football field, find a park, and do 50-yard sprints, 100-yard sprints. You sprint out for 50 yards, 100 yards, you walk back or jog back to where you started from before. You do that 5 times, and you will be sucking wind at the end of that. You can incorporate sprints with bear crawling, crab crawling, lunges, push-ups, crunchies, jumping jacks, and you can do a workout thing where you do a strenuous workout, like maybe bear crawl or crab crawl, for 60 minutes, for 1 minute. And if you can have a stopwatch with you, or you can have some kind of maybe a training partner who's going to time you, and then you rest for 20 seconds after your 40-second or 60-second rep there of doing something, whether it be push-ups, whether it be squats, freehand squats, no weights. You know, you're going to learn real quick that guys that are enslaved to the weights, enslaved to the gym, right? They have to work out. They have to get their bulging muscles. They just don't feel like a man without 25-inch biceps. Let me tell you something. Big muscles require a lot of oxygen. And if you're in a fight and you got multiple opponents, I'm telling you, I've seen it too many times. If I had a dollar for every time I've seen that, I could put a good down payment on a brand new car. You will gas out. So don't go for big muscles. Don't go for, you know, don't try to impress the women with that. You know, go for functional exercise for combat fitness. All right. So, yeah, do road marches with a pack, you know, but incorporate that with other things. Body weight exercise is the best thing for you. Okay. Question, how should a night march in the country be made? Answer, during the night it is necessary to walk as if you were pedaling a bicycle, raising the legs high with each step. This is done to avoid tripping over stones, tree trunks, other objects in the road. A gorilla will consult his compass at least every hour to check his direction. If he has no compass, he will orientate himself by means of the North Star. Said knowledge having been gained from our textbooks, on starless nights, it is recommended that he orientate himself by means of the trees, in so much as in our countries, trees have mosses and other growths on the north side of the trunk. Well, I don't... How should a night march be done in a country? You know what? I do recommend at least a couple times a month, that you walk through the forest at night alone. If you got coyotes in your area, you got bobcats, mountain lions, whatever, you may need to bring a firearm or something. But if you're in an area that don't have a lot of that, I recommend just a couple times a month, get used to walking through the forest at night as stealthily as you can, and you'd be amazed that if you can do that, walk through the forest at night for a couple hours at night alone, with a machete, with a knife, with a flashlight, just in case you run into something. But by all means, get used to practicing security halts. Practice walking in a way that doesn't make a lot of noise. Heel to toe. Slowly, heel to toe. You're going downhill, heel to toe. You're going uphill. You're going to probably be mostly on the balls of your feet. Move slowly, move stealthily as you can. Practice this. And you'd be amazed if you do that a few times and you make that a regular practice, walking through a forest or through woods at night alone on a regular basis, you get comfortable with that, man, you'll get comfortable, hiding in some shrubs or hiding in some bushes in an apartment complex, keeping an eye on somebody who's become an enemy of our race. You'll be amazed at just how much your courage and your intestinal fortitude goes up if you make walking through forests a regular part of your training at night. Okay. Question, how should the members of a guerrilla unit act toward one another? Answer, everyone should be very good friends, or at least compatible. All offensive jokes should be forbidden. Jokes and poor taste separate them and create bad feelings among them, thus weakening the spirit of the unity. You know, if you have a guerrilla band and you have a guy who's, a little bit weaker than the rest, encourage him. Bring him up to snuff. Don't belittle him. Don't berate him. By all means, don't do that. That's not going to be any good. That's going to be the weak link in your chain. And you want to make the weakest link of your chain as strong as you possibly can. Okay. Question, how does one orientate himself during the day? Answer, by means of the sun. In order to orientate yourself, you stand with your right hand pointing to the place where the sun rises, which will be the east. The opposite side, the west. The front will be the north, and the rear will be the south. You can also use the shadow tip method if you got sun and you got a field. You know, you guys probably know the shadow tip method. Question. When in the country and we come upon a thatched hut of a farmer, what should we do before entering it for the first time? Answer. Only two of our men will enter. The rest will surround the house. Those entering will notify its inhabitants that the hut is surrounded. When an accurate inspection of the house and surrounding area has been made, the rest of the force can enter. Sentries will be placed on the hills or high ground that control the roads and the approaches to the area where the hut is. Once we are inside, no one will be allowed to leave since he might. Person leaving, since he might warn the enemy. The officer in charge of recruiting will talk to the farmer and evaluate his true feelings and loyalty toward us. After this, he will be asked to help us as an informer or as a guerrilla farmer. Think about that. Make him an offer he can't refuse and say, listen, maybe a couple times a week, we're going to come to you for produce. I don't know, tomatoes, carrots, whatever you can help us out with. You know, because we're men undercover, and we're guerrillas, and, you know, when we come into power, we'll make sure that you're rewarded richly for your support. If you don't help us out, well, you may not wake up one night. Okay. If he refuses to cooperate, he will be evicted from his hut. Oh, okay. And as a friend to the dictatorship, he will be forced to leave. We cannot allow any potential enemies to remain. Once he is ordered to leave, we will confiscate all his property without any compensation. All his possessions become booty of war. Wow. That's a pretty hardcore stance there. Can't say I disagree with it. You know what? Drastic times call for drastic measures. And we live in drastic times now. Just because we're not being rounded up by the secret police in this country, just because, you know, we can go to and from, you know, without any real hassle, doesn't mean that shit isn't bad right now. You know, a lot of you, maybe some of you out there listening say, you know what, I got it good right now, I have no complaints. But you don't realize that you are a slave. You're a wage slave. And you may think, no, I'm not. I got plenty of money. I can go out and buy as many CDs and DVDs as I want. I can go out and buy a plasma TV right now, maybe put a good down payment on a new car, you know, maybe readjust my mortgage on my house. Let me ask you something. Can you take off work, just don't work for a whole year? Could you make it? Probably not. You are a slave. I mean, think about it. We depend on the government for everything. And people who are self-reliant and, you know, really depend on their own two hands to get whatever they got, you know, maybe you got a plot of ground that you like to grow produce in. Maybe you do your own hunting. Maybe you don't need to go to the grocery store. But think about it. Not too many of us can do that. And we depend on the system that is robbing us of our future and our birthright. And you blacks, if there's any blacks listening to this, that's right. We have a birthright. We whites have a birthright to this country and to every other country. Every other country where the white diaspora has spread to. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Europe. We went to all these places. We built a great civilization. Our forefathers did. Yeah, we dispossessed some people. You know, but as far as I can see, we dispossessed people who weren't doing nothing with the land. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. There'd be nothing but teepees in Buffalo where I'm sitting right now if the white man hadn't have come here. These so-called noble savages, or whatever you want to call the so-called Native Americans. I mean, you know, they made no technological advances in the whole 20 or 10,000 years they were on North America. You know, I mean, archaeologists haven't shown any progress in their technology from the time they walked across the Aleutian Land Bridge. And look what we did in the short 200 years we've been here. Look what we've done. We've taken a world that had no mass communications, no mass transportation, and basically the whole world is filled with it now because of the white man. This is our birthright. We have a right to this land more so than any other race. We are the ones who built civilization. We are the ones who found all these cures to diseases that have benefited black and brown. This is our birthright, and we are being robbed of it. All right, I don't know how much time I have left. I think I got 20 minutes left. I'm not really sure. I want to go into War of the Flea. I want to read about General Grievous. Chapter 8, General Grievous, on guerrilla war in Cyprus, the political use of terrorism, and the errors of British strategy. Okay, here we go. War of the Flea. The British, who armed their commandos with knives and instruct them to kill from the rear, protested vigorously when such tactics were applied to themselves. It may be argued that these things are only permissible in war. This is nonsense. I was fighting a war in Cyprus against the British, and if they did not recognize the fact from the start, they were forced to at the end. The truth is that our form of war, in which a few hundred fell in 4 years, was more selective than most. And I speak as one who has seen battlefields covered with dead. We did not strike like the bomber at random. We shot only British servicemen who would have killed us if they could have fired first, and civilians who were traitors or intelligence agents. To shoot down your enemies in the street may be unprecedented, but I was looking for results, not precedents. How did Napoleon win his victories? He took his opponents in the flank or rear, and what is right on the grand scale is not wrong when the scale is reduced to the odds against you, when the odds against you are 100-1. That's some pretty profound stuff there. I mean, we have no power in this country. The white working class have no power. But we have disruptive power. And if you are not using that, knowing what we know, you're wrong. And you know deep down in your own heart, maybe the other people don't know, you know deep down in your own heart that you're a coward. You know, that's one thing about the lone wolf leaderless resistance. There's no accountability. But if we can start off small, start off as individuals, maybe when things really weaken in the system and in the government and in society, maybe we could form bands, small bands. These bands could become platoon-sized elements and then just grow from there. But we're not going to do any growing when the system is so, you know, seemingly everywhere, when it seemingly all-knowing. They really don't know all, but they seem to know all. So we don't need to worry about the rules of war and the rules of law and this and that. We are outnumbered. We are our enemy has more resources. 90% of the white race has been turned against us. We're trying to save their lily white asses and the future of their white kids. But they've been turned against us. Why should we play fair? Why should we play this game inside the box? If there's one thing that pisses me off is this white people who, you know, I had someone tell me the other day, we were talking about fighting, and I told him about an incident where I was sitting at this table, and there was a big guy, just, you know, I mean, this guy in any kind of fight, you know, a fight where there's like a UFC-type fight, this guy would kick the hell out of me any day of the week and seven times on Sunday. I mean, this guy, I mean, he was a lot bigger and stronger than me. He was younger than me. He was faster than me. He had more energy than me. But this guy, you know, I'm sitting at this table, you know, we're all just drinking, having a good time. This happened years ago, by the way. And you know, this guy was sitting on the same side of the table I'm sitting on, but he's just talking a lot of shit about me. And finally I said, you know what? What the fuck's your problem? And he said, you know, I'll tell you what my problem is. I can get up right now and just freaking annihilate you. I can just take your life right now. So you better shut your damn mouth. I'll say whatever I want to say. I'm like, all right, man. Sorry, man. Cool. You know, cool. Forget it. I didn't mean to piss you off, man. So I got up out of my seat, and I was making for like I was going towards the cooler that had the beer in it in the back of the room. Well, he has his back to me, and he started talking more shit, not really about me, but about other things or whatever. And I saw a golf club. You know, it wasn't in a golf club bag or whatever. I saw a golf club, a solo golf club. I don't know if it was a driver or a wedge. I don't know the game of golf. It was a golf club. I pick up that golf club, he's got his back to me, so he didn't see it coming. But, you know, I wonder if the people across the table, you know, I'm sure he saw maybe at the last second the look of shock on their face because they saw me coming. And I clubbed the shit out of this guy. I fucked him up with a capital F-U. I mean, man, I don't want to give too many details about that, but and I told the rest of the people, whoever goes to the police and says anything, I will fucking kill you. And I put this guy, I didn't kill him, but I fucked him up real bad, and I put him in the hospital. And you know what? He never said shit to me again. And I was telling this story to someone the other day, and he said, you know, you're a dirty fighter. I'm like, dirty fighter? That would mean that that I abide by some kind of rules. I don't abide by any rules. I am a law unto myself, and that's one thing I want to pass on to you guys. Forget about the laws of the land or the laws of, you know, fair street fighting or, you know, oh, you don't fight fair. Don't ever fight fair. Don't ever fight fair in a fight. Don't ever fight fair in a political war. Don't worry. I mean, don't burden yourselves with the rules of men. The rules that can find you, that can find the parameters of your mind, that can find all of your possibilities and how you can fight against a system that is destroying our race. If you abide by, who are those men? They're men who have body odor just like you. They have morning breath just like you. They fart and shit just like you. They piss just like you. I mean, if they work out and they would stink just like you, who are they? Forget about the rules of men, the rule of law, and all this other shit that just, you know, puts shackles on our mind. Break the chains. You are a law unto yourself, and to thy own self be true. You know, a lot of guys, they act and talk like a tough guy out there, and then they can't back it up, but inside their mind, they want to be this badass. Be true to yourself. To thy own self, be true. If you're not a badass, if you're not this big, tough guy who's real good at street fighting, you could be effective in another way. If I would have fought this guy, I would have lost. So I decided to use deception. When I told him, hey, relax, man, no problem. I don't want no problem with you, man. You know, he thought I was afraid of him. He thought, man, I got this guy Buffalo, man. There's no way this guy would ever mess with me. Well, when I made like I was going to get a beer out of the cooler, and then I attacked him with a golf club, fucking him up, his whole perception changed to me. And it changed forever. I mean, I've seen him since then a couple of times. He won't say nothing to me. So stop playing by the rules. Stop fighting fair. Stop playing this game within the parameters of the box. Get out of the fucking box. Get out of the playpen, the right-wing bullshit playpen that has only done nothing but waste resources in the struggle since the 20s. Disaffected people and frustrated potential. How many people have left this movement who could have been great leaders because they're just so frustrated with bullshit? Get out of the box. Get out of the playpen and stop playing fair. 14.
Well, there he goes. Gorilla Wolfman. How you like that? Yeah, from the heartland. You'll be back pretty soon with some more information that's going to get you all excited. Make you want to stand up and yell, say, get him, man! Yeah. Well, this is Terrible Tommy. That's it. B-show done. In the box. in the tube, ready to go. Here it comes. Here we go. 14 words.
Fluffy, furry buddy, chewed his leg on the porch. Why'd you do it, Fluffy, on the porch? Good dog, Fluffy, old friend, my pal. Fluffy's got his buddy on the porch. Penny, she's my girlie. She sits here with me on the porch. Penny looks so pretty on the porch. Penny takes Fluffy